Thank you very much. We're going to take time for a few more questions.
I should have said, I've never been the warm-up act for Matthew Fox before, but I'm pretty excited about that. Matthew Fox was my introduction to prayer when I was in seminary. His book, To a Dancing Bear, and I have loved him from afar for that. Patricia.
Thank you. That was a wonderful, powerful talk you gave us. I'm just, at the time of 9/11 happened, I wanted to say there was a reason why it happened. And we never dealt with that. And it seems to me that now we had these two terrible wars, however many there are, there's almost countless numbers of wars. And here we are with ISIS ahead of us, and how do we deal with that? We failed miserably 13 years ago, and are we going to go into the same kind of cycle today?
Thank you for these insights and memories of these events. Any questions? Anything else? At the moment? Comments?
My name is Sherry, and seldom has a lecture hit me so personally in terms of truth and forgiveness, because it's something I've been wrestling with in my personal life. I have a son who's in jail. He's going to get out in a couple of weeks. He's been in jail many, many times for parole violations. Actually spent some time in prison. I want to be able to forgive him for the constant lies, and I do mean constant. But I doubt very much if he'll ever admit to any of them, even though I know a lot of them and probably a heck of a lot that I don't know. And they're pretty egregious things, like his car, the windows were smashed and he claimed it was vandalized, and I found out later that he did it himself in a fit of rage. He has real rage problems. He's adopted. He was a fetal alcohol syndrome baby, or at least every therapist he's ever had, beginning as soon as he could talk, has said that. Is there a way to forgive without getting the truth? Is it enough that I know the truth, or is it necessary for him to have a frank conversation with me? Because I don't think he will, and yet not being able to forgive him, I haven't spoken to him, by the way, since he was arrested last August. I want to be able to forgive him. He's my son. He does have mental problems from being, a crack baby, and now he's, using drugs off and on. Can you forgive without getting the truth from him, or is it enough that I know the truth?
That is so tough. That is so hard. I think very often with forgiveness, it's not really a two-way conversation. It happens within us. And I think it's kind of like prayer, in that the point is not necessarily to get the outcome that we're praying for. It's to change us as the person who prays. The point of forgiveness is that I begin by acknowledging the truth within myself. I know the real truth. I know what happened here. He maybe can't know that or can't admit that for whatever reasons, and we can't control how somebody else understands the world. But if we can begin by that kind of releasing, which I think this book goes into in a pretty helpful way and is, a few weeks down the road in your study here, about the fact that forgiveness is off, you release him from needing to be who you'd like him to be. And that's how the kind of forgiveness that we often have to do with our parents or others who have hurt us deep in our past, when there isn't going to be a conversation with them. We can't sit down and talk. That's usually the hardest kind of forgiveness, I believe. Because it's not like we can reasonably come to some agreement. It's usually beyond that. So that's a real deep internal piece of work. Hey, Jackie.
though.
Come closer.
Right up here. Okay, take a bite out of it.
Yeah.
Back to the 9/11, I have wondered from time to time in great naivete, but sometimes you have to be that way. What would happen if a delegation of our leaders met with some of the leaders that are causing the greatest trouble, or had met back in 9/11, and said, please forgive us for allowing you to hate us so much, and what can we do to change the situation? Now, that is totally naive, but in a perfect world, that's what we could do. I'm sorry you feel that way about us. And that's a kind of a, as I said, naive for 3,000 people killed. We don't forgive the sin necessarily, because it was wrong to do it, but we look in horror upon the fact that we are so hated that somebody would want to do that to us. And what could we do to change it? Instead of bombing the hell out of them and capturing all their leaders, which only leads to escalation. Everybody knows that. One war always leads to another.
Yeah.
People have long memories. You did this to us. We're going to do that to you. It would stop if we forgave them.
Well, it's hard to imagine that, isn't it? But I could imagine a national conversation or a series of local conversations around the topic. Why do you think other people hate us?
Imagine really having that discussed.
American conversation. I preached that right after 9/11 and somebody walked out on me.
Only one?
Only one, actually, yeah. But imagine if we really were to look at how, as I said, how we are as a member of the global family. The resources that we guzzle up. Michael, did you have a question? No. You do have a question. Okay.
You know, in addressing this issue about our national attitude and why we're hated so much, there was a book written probably 40 or 50 years ago called The Ugly America.
Sure.
And that might be a starting place for us to work on.
That was at the beginning of Vietnam. Michael, okay, your turn. I see you back there.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Michael.
The point you make, one of the points you've made this morning and the point that I got out of the very beginning of the book that we read for today was about truth, about really examining what is the truth. But an aspect of that is looking at ourselves as well. And I just wondered if you had some comments on what makes self-examination in that process so challenging.
Well, because we would prefer to not see the truth of ourselves, I think, always. We prefer to think well of ourselves, that we are kind and generous and loving individuals, that we, you know, don't waste water and that we, you know, all that. When in fact sometimes we're not always kind and generous and loving, or that we're caught up in a world that doesn't allow us to be. Sometimes it's not just our own individual intention, but I think it's so easy to be deluded about yourself. Wow. I mean, it's the easiest place to be deluded. We can have far better clarity of vision about somebody else than we can about ourselves, right? That's the great work of contemplative prayer. That's what Richard Rohr, I keep quoting him today just because I got a new book of his earlier. But that's the great work of contemplative prayer. It's the work of therapy. It's that taking off the mask, you know. And I think it's what Jesus was talking about all the time, about seeing who we really are and trying to live out of that place, act out of that place. It's not easy. And all the forces around us collude for deception, I think. You know, we're supposed to look differently than we maybe look. We're supposed to dress differently than we maybe want to dress. You know, it's often not appropriate to wear red cowboy boots, but They're my most comfortable shoes, and they give me courage. That's the truth. And I've had this very same pair since 1992. I've had them reheeled once. Bill.
I think you've proven it's always appropriate to wear red cowboy boots. So my question is about forgiveness in public life. And you brought up President Bush and the war in Iraq. And
I never said his name.
Noted. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal's lead editorial said simply, Dick Cheney was right. And between,
really?
Between Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld and people who led us into that war, and you know, public officials who may do things that we deeply disagree with, whether it's you know making it harder for kids to get food or people to get jobs. What do you think about forgiveness for folks like that? How do we let it go for President Bush and for Dick Cheney?
I think we shouldn't. I think we should demand the truth. I mean, there have been many who have demanded, who want to demand that Cheney go on trial for lying. I don't think we demand the truth from our leaders. I think pretty much we distract ourselves, you know, I mean, with whatever game is going on the phone or something else. I think we don't want to be bothered. I think it's hard work to have to demand truth from someone. It's easier to let it go and go on to the, as our first speaker, as Max said, it's easier to let it go and just keep going on with the conversation. You know, conflict is no fun, whether it's at the dinner table or, you know, on a national setting. So, and I don't know what the setting would be for that. For me, that's about the restoration of democracy. It's about showing up at City Hall and showing up at the County Board of Supervisors, showing up at the school board meetings, because that's where we engage democracy. I think we have let democracy slip away from us. And one of my greatest worries, actually.
It's a big worry.
Yeah. So
okay, good. I didn't want to let it go.
I don't think we forgive until we demand truth. We start telling the real story. Then maybe you get to the path of forgiveness. But you don't start at forgiveness, I don't believe, because that would be lying. Mm-hmm. That would be just letting them off easy, I think.
Thank you.
Don, you have a question.
Yes, an observation, maybe, first, and then a question. One of the things that I do very much in the therapy room, is look at what the, say, opening throwaway conversation is about as a key to the shape of the whole hour. And it's amazing. It is amazing how it's as though, you know, in the blink, when you first come in, you know what it's about, but you have to get to it through another language. Now, this is maybe a jump from that, but I think that other things happening in the on the planet, in the world, that are getting our attention could also maybe be a metaphor for how difficult truth and reconciliation is. And I'm thinking of the Ebola virus and its care and possible containment and dealing with it. I mean, when I think of the Ebola virus, I think often with great relief that I'm not eligible to go and be one of the caregivers. But if I were to go and be one of the caregivers, I would have to realize this is hard work. It's not work you can take casually, not work where omnipotence plays a role. It's one in which one has to go into incredibly delicately. And so that's all sort of like illustrated by having to cover oneself from head to toe. Mm. So I'm wondering if that provides you or anybody else in the group with an idea of what are some of the strategies we might have to do in order to enter into speaking truth to power, speaking truth to the enemy and to ourselves about how big this task is.
Mm. Thank you. That's a powerful metaphor. Certainly the idea of being so careful, having to be so gingerly about our movements with something that is so fraught as Ebola, or as so fraught as the tensions, say, in the Gaza. Where is the scripture about how we're clothed with the garment of truth? Ephesians 6. We have a biblical scholar in our midst. Thank you. You know, imagine if that was something we did in the morning when we woke up and thought, you know, I want to clothe myself in truth today. To kind of start paring away the illusions just individually. And I don't, what would that be like? Other thoughts about that? How we might speak to issues of wrongdoing using this metaphor of Ebola?
Power.
Yes, Don has given the metaphor of the contagion of Ebola for the way that we have used and abused power, the contagion of power. And of, I think that's somewhat what was behind my comments about how we are, as a member of the human family, consuming, guzzling so much of the world's everything, from oil to any other mineral. I heard from a person who won't come up to the mic because he's such a dear and humble person, but he told me that at the break that he wrote a letter after 9/11 to President Bush and said in that letter, and I won't quote it well enough, but he said that what if we were to not return evil with evil, but what if we were to return evil with good? What if we were to come to your countries and build schools? What if we were to bring, you know, not bombs, but building materials? What if we were to, you know, basically turn the other cheek, forgive a gazillion times, 7 times 7? And I thought it was a brave and powerful letter to write. I don't think it got read. Ma'am.
My question is along the same line. What is the truth? Can the perception of truth vary from people based on where they are at? Two people can see the Middle East and the conflict from their own perception. Each one believes they have the truth. One says, kill them all, and the other one says, let's build schools. So how do you get past this, the level of perception, and the contemplative mind has a more open heart? Yeah. The other one, they both might quote the Bible, but one might quote Jesus and the other one the Old Testament, an eye for an eye. How does one cross that barrier, or is it even crossable? Is that a change that has to come from within? I just think the tribal level of the Middle East may not mix well with democracy. Mm. So that's my question. The truth can vary based on the consciousness level of the people.
Everyone comes at the truth from their own perspective, to be sure. I think of what happened in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, where we had people on absolute opposite sides of that bloodbath, people who had been, who were supposedly saving South Africa from the majority population, and we had people who were being slaughtered by that. It's only really when they met in the same room and looked each other in the eye that they began to get some glimmer of their common humanity. And I think I think it starts really small. You know, I think it starts with talking about our grandchildren or talking about the kind of food we like to eat or something. It starts really small. And I didn't used to think that. I thought it started with a movement. But I'm too old now to think that anymore. But I think we still need the movement. I think we ought to be in the streets, quite likely. I think that's what we need in Ferguson. I don't think you go out there with armor. I don't think we give bayonets to our local police forces. Policing is a great, skillful, wonderful kind of work. And good policemen are such a great thing in communities, which I also never thought as a young person in the 60s, of course. But you don't go around your local blocks in armor. So the police need to be face-to-face with the people that they are policing. Tom.
Yes, in your opening homily sermon, you reminded us of the way that we sometimes just are blind to things. I mean, we don't get it when we see a huge hurricane, for example. And it's hard to place a blame on the violence of a hurricane. But there are other things in our society where we are also, I think, comparably blind. And I just wanted to raise two of them. One of them is handguns and all the havoc that they wreak on our society. And the other one is the thousands, and I'm saying thousands, of nuclear weapons which we have built, constructed, tested, stored, aimed, ready to deliver. And it's often just two heartbeats away before one of those things gets launched. And so, you know, part of this business of forgiveness is I don't want to be in the position of having to forgive the person that inadvertently launches the missile that brings down that airliner, for example. And I don't want to be in the position of having to forgive whoever launches the next nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. So there's an element of prudence in here that isn't there that plays into the whole structure of where we are in our and when and how we forgive. If you anticipate, you know, needing to forgive, you may anticipate, well, why would I need to forgive unless somebody did this or that or the other? And would it not be prudent for me to head them off at the pass? Don't wait for the disaster. That's the question is, can we do that?
None of these are easy. I mean, I think that's why, you know, we have these conversations about ISIS right now that we had about Hitler. You know, this is something that should be stopped. These are vicious people doing vicious things in the world. We can't allow that. But this is a path. It's this fourfold path. The first piece of the path is telling the story. And I think that's, to talk about forgiveness, I think, stops us in our tracks. Because it immediately means, oh my gosh, I have to be this loving, forgiving person. And I don't want to get there. I think we have to back up those three steps to, what is the story here? What's the story? You know, why are we armed to the teeth? We're armed to the teeth for one reason, because of the military-industrial complex that keeps those weapons being built, even though it has slowed down a bit, because there's money to be made. There's money to be made there. So a lot of it just says, when we look at something that's awful and looks like it needs to be forgiven, what's the true story there? What's the backstory? What's the backstory? It's very rarely what we might get on television. And it takes some real diligence and homework on our part, again, as faithful, as people of faith, and as people who live in a democracy. It's up to us.
And it's never too late to understand. And understanding opens up all sorts of things. Like, we in America have here a one-sided part of the Middle East conflict, predominantly over the other part. And when my husband and I took a group of students from Westmont College over to Israel, we decided that we would have a tour guide that was not Israeli, but one that was Palestinian. And I did not understand until that moment what was happening there and the other side of the story. Mm-hmm. So it's never too late to go back and see actually what is behind the story. And we could even see then, this is not going to end well unless something is done to bring the sides together. And so we went to Lebanon, decided to go to Lebanon after we met some people at the National Prayer Breakfast, and another met with lots of leaders and things. A lot of things don't happen through governments, but can happen through people mm-hmm. instead of governments. Mm-hmm. So building friendships across the line at the National Prayer Breakfast, they bring people together from different sides. They've brought the Crips and the Bloods together, the leaders at times, to talk to one another. So there's things that we can do. But we also, like you said, we have to be willing to look at ourselves. So like if we're having trouble with a child and we want them to tell the truth might end up also him or her telling things that are true about his experience of us. Yeah. And we want to hear their truth, but we don't want to have to deal with our own truth.
Yeah, that's the hardest when it's a child.
Yeah. So that I think if we would go back, and there is a good book on the Palestinian side that goes back called Blood Brothers by a Christian Palestinian, Elias Shakur.
Oh, sure.
And we read that, and it was a great mm-hmm. thing to help us understand at least what was brewing mm-hmm. that was causing so much resentment mm-hmm. and to help understand what is our part in that. Because we do have a part. Mm-hmm. And we were sympathetic to Israel, which we should be after what happened in the Holocaust, but had the blinders on as to the actions that we took in conjunction with them and what it meant to other people who were living there.
So. Well, there's the next book for Word and Life, Elias Shakur. He also has a wonderful version of the Beatitudes, an interesting translation of the Beatitudes. Instead of saying blessed are the poor in spirit, I think he said, was it like rise up? Anyway, I'm not going to quote it right now. But Shakur, Shakour, Elias. He's maybe a priest, Catholic priest maybe. Also, Desmond Tutu has talked so much about Israel and Palestine, saying, you know, that talking about the fourfold path and telling the truth, it goes way back for Israel to deal with the terrible wrong of World War II and to begin to forgive. And when Desmond Tutu said that, I don't know exactly what he said or how he said it, but, you know, that's the beginning piece of work there, to do that forgiveness, which has got to be so hard. He was, of course, accused of being anti-Semitic. So the contagion, the metaphor from Dawn, well, the contagion goes on. The contagion of hate continues. That's what Martin Luther King said. Violence is a spiral that only is ever downward moving.
During the summer, when we experience so much tragedy and so much horror all over the world, I keep asking myself, you know, why, we all do, but I think about the roots, about Abraham and Moses and who they were, who Jesus was, and who Muhammad was. And why do all these people follow these leaders? And the way I answered it was because they see a reflection of the great good in some way or another, but the person of goodness, I guess. And they're attracted to that. And we all have books, and we all read those books. And those books, the Book of Islam, is very positive from what I've been told. And the book, the scriptures are very positive about how we should behave and how we should be a community. And so we have roots. I think we look at our people as not leaders but models of who we should be. And I'm not sure that this answers any question or not, but it's a reflection on where who we need to be in following those models.
Thank you. Well, and I've often thought over these last years, especially since 9/11, and my whole work is about this, you know, where are the voices of faith in the public square calling for peace and calling for compassion and calling for love? If that is at the core of all of our religions, which it is, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, as well as other world religions, they're all based on compassion and on an ethic of neighbor love, really. Those aren't the loudest voices of faith that we've heard or that we were hearing after 9/11 or even leading up to it. The loudest voices of faith in our country certainly were voices that were very pro-war, very militaristic. So people of faith need to take a look at who their models are and speak from that place, I believe.
I am Sue. Father Brian Cox at the Christ the King Episcopal Church has written a book called Faith-Based Reconciliation. And he's taken that the 8 steps overseas and has met with various leaders of conflicting parties in Israel and all. And he had, they did it at the church. So, I mean, we had the church community done it. And you had mentioned something about starting at the beginning, you know, and that's what the first step is. We sat around the table and where are you from? You know, what's your family like? What's your heritage? What's your world belief? And then every step got a little more serious, and the 8th step was to go away and come back with how we can heal the forgiveness or the angst that we were brought about the table to talk about. And it's just to me that's the only way we're going to get anything done. But it seems like such a small part of the wars and all that, but it's a beginning.
Thank you. I think that it's always a small start. I mean, I think that's what was happening when folks gathered and shared some bread and wine and told some stories together in Palestine 2,000 years ago. It was a small start, but it's a start we keep on. Yes, sir.
I recently saw something on television about the 90s, and it brought up President Clinton and his problem with Monica Lewinsky. It was interesting how he kept denying it until finally the evidence was overwhelming. He's about to be impeached. He just said, okay, I did it. And then later on, I heard he said, I did it because I could. He was a powerful person. And you wonder about people in power like that want to cover up things, you know. And I suppose it's a temptation. You know, nobody wants to look bad, especially if you're in a public position. Do you have any observations on that?
I think all of us have the capacity to lie to ourselves about the wrong that we do. And I think sometimes maybe the more power we have, the more hubris we have, the more we think we can get away with. And usually, if you're a person of power, you figure you can get away with more. My job with the bishop as canon to the ordinary was working on the issue in the Episcopal Church in the Diocese of Los Angeles, was working on the issue of sexual misconduct among priests. And what I learned there, which was news to me at the time, this is now 20 plus years ago, that almost always it was never about sex, but it was always about power. It's about power. And about priests who were overworked and overstressed and didn't know how to take care of themselves or live lives of integrity, so acted out. Power is very dangerous. I think Tony Campolo turned him around a bit, though, but after the fact. But I think lying is, you know, when we see it in high places like that, it's so it's easy to see, but it's certainly not limited to people of great power. All of us have the ability to hide that little part of ourselves that, you know, we want to keep hidden. Everybody's got a secret. Everybody's got something. Yeah. Yes. And then, are there any others? We're okay. You're two. Go ahead. Go ahead, Max. Okay. Anna's going to limit this to people who. Now we want new voices. But you get up here if you want to. You know, wield that power.
I think we grow up hearing a phrase that keeps us from forgiving, and that is forgive and forget. And I think there's no way I can forget what someone did to me. And if I dare forget, the next time they try to do it, I won't be prepared. I won't be able to. I think that phrase has to be eliminated. Yeah. I think we need to be able to forgive and remember. And I have also heard another definition of forgiving is letting go of an idea of revenge. Repaying, relinquishing that.
Right.
And I don't think we need to forget to do that either.
We don't forget, do we? We don't forget.
How can we?
But, you know, and that's where, again, Tutu starts with tell the story. You don't start out by forgetting the wrong. You start out by telling the story, naming the hurt. And then you can go on.
I think one of our problems also is the absolute deliciousness of resentment.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And how empowering it is to feel angry.
Yes.
And I think that those are things we really need to face before we can let go. You know, what is it about me that needs to be so angry? What is it about me that needs to hold on to this resentment? So
lots
of things to look at.
Well, and that reminds me, you know, so much of what we're talking about is the response, you know, the violent response that we see in public that comes from anger. I mean, I certainly think we have seen anger on display in the actions of ISIS and elsewhere. But we all know that anger is one of those masks. I'm sure the therapists in the room can help me out here. But I have learned that whenever I get angry, I have to like kind of gulp and say, okay, why am I hurt? It's almost always that I'm hurt. And it's almost always my ego that's hurt. So then, you know, I have to just back up and do a whole bunch of more looking at myself and cutting through all my great illusions. So, but anger is usually just a mask. Sometimes there is a righteous need for anger, certainly for some wrong that is done. But
I agree. The hurt is so much the basis of it. But I was also thinking, when you were talking about the military-industrial complex and the stockpiling of nuclear weapons, and there being money behind that and power, and I was thinking how those people with money and power capitalized on fear of people.
Skillfully.
In thinking the fear continues to drive so much of what happens in the world today, and how do we deal with that? It's besides learning to deal with our hurt, we have to learn to deal with our own fears and as communities with fear.
Well, we are swimming in a sea of fear. I have preached about this one way too many times. But, you know, everything around us, we live in a culture that just ramps up our fears, whether it's the latest drug ad on the evening news or, you know, my teeth aren't white enough and I got to get some other product, you know. To great fear of the other. our fear is fanned by everything in our culture, partly because it makes us buy stuff, which may be the bottom line about everything, about us being consumers of the world's goods and resources. But, so, yeah, we got to deal with fear. Do we have a book on fear that we could do after this one on forgiveness?
I just wanted to acknowledge Pope Francis and his efforts towards reconciliation.
Yes. Thank you, Pope Francis. You know, it's a great word if Bill Burton were still here. He might confirm this. The people in Washington talk about the Francis effect. Francis is indeed having an effect on some people's way of regarding public policy, on things that matter for children, like food and nutrition programs and things like that. But all of a sudden, here we have a pope talking about justice. Imagine that. Imagine that. I think it's a great new day in that regard. So, okay. I think, is that it? Do we have any more questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.